This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's jump right into our week in review, which was dominated by heavy winter weather, which, among other things, exposed the fragility of Boston's old, creaky, and underfinanced MBTA.
Quite candidly, if you don't have to wind up using the service, that probably is a plus.
New funds for repairs might help, but it's doubtful they'll come from the state as Governor Charlie Baker announces $500 million in cuts to close a budget gap.
Considering the size of the gap, it is not, I think, going to be quite as painful as I had feared.
Also this week, supporters of net neutrality cheer a new plan by the FCC to regulate the internet, which they say will protect everyday users and innovators.
We need a Darwinian paranoia-inducing competition in the marketplace.
And protesters gear up for an appearance at the Wilbur Theater this weekend by comedian Bill Cosby, accused of drugging and sexually assaulting more than 24 women.
I mean, I was woozy, my speech was slurred. I knew that I was in danger.
Joining me to talk about these stories and the rest of the week's news is Jim Sturgis. He's the executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good to be with you.
Also, Marcela Garcia, editorial page contributor at the Boston Globe, joins us from Morrissey Boulevard. Hi, Marcela. Good to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. So let's start off with the MBTA. Winter has clobbered the city with record snow and cold and sent the brittle T down for the count, almost. Anyway, let's say it's on its knees. Here's State Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack. We talked to her earlier this week. She says that we're stuck with a rickety system for the near future.
We lost a huge percentage of the vehicles. We had power problems. We had signal problems. That said, we're going to be operating with those same vehicles for years to come, and we need to do the best possible job we can.
Marcel, I'll start with you. What do you think about the fate of the future of Boston having to deal with essentially a system that seems to become paralyzed in winter weather?
It's absolutely dismal. I think it's kind of amazing that it took a snowstorm like this one to actually expose the incredible problems that have plagued the MBTA for so long. Only a few people were really aware of the big problems it faces, starting with the debt and the interest and you know, all this huge maintenance delays that really add up to $10-13 billion. So now it really took a snowstorm to put things in perspective, and that's kind of sad, number one. And number two, it's really going to take a long time. I don't think it's going to get solved in the near future. Some people are saying the Olympics bid, just to insert more controversy in the issue, may help or catalyze this, you know, the improvements to the infrastructure. But the reality is that I remain very, very cynical, and it's going to take a huge effort. The legislature.
Yeah, a huge effort and lots of money. We talked to Michael Widmer, the former head of the Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation, and here's what he said about the system.
I don't know how we're going to handle the problems at the T, because we're paying the price this week for years of underfunding. We should be funding the T capital investments at least $200 million more a year than we are. So we're not talking about $5 million Band-Aids. Mm. And there's no easy answer because of the collision of political will and the reality of underfunding over many years.
So, Jim, the MBTA owes nearly $9 billion in debt and interest and faces a $3 billion maintenance backlog. I've heard that number put as high as $5 billion. What's it going to take to fix this?
Well, you know, it's a great question. I mean, I think the question I would put is, why is it we have 35-year-old subway cars on the Orange Line and 45-year-old subway cars on the Red Line, and why do we have to wait 3 years to get 300 new ones? And I think it is, it's not just a matter of funding. It's not just a matter of underfunding. I mean, we've increased the gas tax modestly. We also added a sales tax increase a few years back to try and deal with this. So we've added some funding. I think Charlie Chipio had it right in the Globe today, where he said basically there are three things. We need to be restrained in terms of our expansions. We need to reform many things. And then we do need some more money. On the restraint side, what Mike Widmer just said a second ago is absolutely true. He said we're underfunding the capital accounts for the T. What we are underfunding is the capital accounts dedicated to maintenance. That is changing the signalization, dealing with some of those things that freeze over, replacing the cars. What we've done instead is just consider one thing that we did in the mid-2000s. We built the Greenbush line, $600 million, no federal funding for it. And many of the people who ride the Greenbush line were already taking the T's maritime services. There's really not much wisdom in those sorts of expansions. So I would stop all expansions for now and dedicate all capital accounts to changing those cars out, changing the infrastructure for their already existing system that we have to make sure we actually have a high quality service.
One of the things I wanted to ask you both about, I'll come to you first with this, Marcella, is, you know, I take the point that Jim made, but I also was struck by this, that last November, voters repealed the automatic indexing of the gas tax, and that removed $2 billion from the state budget over the next 10 years. And for that, they'll, I don't know, save a few pennies a month. But so in other words, to what extent is this another example of folks demanding services but being less than willing to pay for them? Marcella, let me start with you.
I think it's really hard for the public to marry those two. When you know, and that's on the media for sure, and also on legislatures. We should all really do a better job at explaining the public what that really means, what that really would have meant. You know, we would have had that was repeated. That was the line that was repeated. You know, money for transportation projects. But it's really hard for the public to understand that. That's probably very dry in people's minds. It doesn't really have a real meaning. And if you add to that the fact that people seem to think that the MBTA is a Boston area, it's just a Boston only problem. That really is not true. And so I think it's on us and the media and the legislatures, for that matter, to do a better job at explaining that, you know, a good MBTA system, a good transportation system benefits everyone, not just people in Boston and people that use it.
Yeah. Jim, do you want to chime in on that question?
Sure. I completely agree. Look, if you have a well-functioning T, you can avoid all kinds of highway projects, which is actually saving money in some ways. But we should remember, my organization was for a gas tax increase, the 3-cent increase that came out. We're also for an additional 3-cent gas tax increase, and we're happy to have that go to transit if we can get the reforms. Now, just remember, this is not new. In the early 1980s, the T was in free fall. And at the time, Barney Frank, then a state rep, put forward something called management rights. That is, he wanted to have the ability to actually deploy people where he needed to deploy them, have people who are working for the T bargain over salaries and benefits, but not over work rules. We've lost most of those management rights. We cannot make the system work well the way it is. So we need, we believe, that gas tax increase we went for, we got it. We think we're in a season of reforms. We need to do those. And then, frankly, after that, we need to invest more money. Invest more money once we know what we can get for it. I mean, we should have cars that actually provide Wi-Fi, that are comfortable in the summer. We mean, we're a great city. And we deserve a better system.
All right. Well, this is a sort of natural segue to the budget. So let's talk about that. Charlie Baker, Governor Charlie Baker, promised during the campaign not to raise taxes. So he's faced with a $768 million shortfall, and cuts have to come somewhere. This week, he announced a plan, big cuts, about $500 million worth of cuts. The cuts will come from Medicaid, transportation, substance abuse, counseling, and education. We heard again from Michael Widmer, the former head of the Massachusetts Taxpayers Foundation, who said the cuts were reasonable and spread the pain around pretty fairly. What's your view, Marcella, on the governor's announcement on this issue?
I think Governor Baker got it exactly right. He focused on programs or initiatives, on cutting programs and initiatives that hadn't even been launched, or things that were just about to happen. And it's hard to find fault with that. You know, there was this Office of the State Climatologist, if I can pronounce that correctly. I don't even know what that means. But the Governor Patrick had established some money for that. It hadn't happened. So things like that he was cutting that I think makes perfect sense. He's looking at this as a numbers game, and I think that's what we expected from Governor Baker. I don't think this is a bad thing at all. And again, if he was focusing on programs that hadn't been launched, I think that's good for now. Now, you know, whether he was cutting in areas that he had been prioritize like substance abuse, again, it was additional money or additional funding that was going to go to that wasn't in place before. So I think from that perspective, I think he got it exactly right.
And we should make the point, too, that this is sort of a short-term fix. We talked to Noah Berger, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, who talked about the challenge for the long term. Here's what he said.
There are different ways to solve the problem. Much of the solutions in this proposal are using revenue that was scheduled to go into our reserve accounts. That's fine for a mid-year solution. It doesn't solve longer-term problems.
So longer-term problems. First of all, Jim, do you agree with that analysis from Noah Berger? Is this only a temporary fix? And how do we deal with the longer-term problems with the budget?
Noah's absolutely right. These are all what they call one-timers. you're sliding over some money from excess capital gains into operating and doing things like that. And as Marcella was saying before, you're not launching things that were to be implemented but not yet implemented. I would say that the long term is probably $1 billion to $1.5 billion in 2016. We're probably looking at in terms of a gap. And frankly, we know where the action's going to be. And that's, again, in Health and Human Services. And that because that's the largest budget item, total about 52% of the state budget. It is growing fast. I think that's where, and that's also Baker's area of expertise. I think he'll have a lot more comfort trying to undertake reforms that could save money there. It's a lot harder to do that, let's say, in education, which so much of the money is actually outlays transfers to local government. That's you cut that, and you're cutting, you know, the direct action in the schools between teachers and kids.
Yeah, right. Well, let's move on to big news this week from the Federal Communications Commission. This week, the FCC announced a plan to regulate the Internet like a public utility, protecting what's called net neutrality. This is the idea that Internet providers should treat all Internet traffic equally. We spoke with Senator Ed Markey, who's been trying to pass net neutrality legislation for almost a decade. He told us that this is about protecting startup businesses as well as consumers.
All the new names that are going to be getting their headlines replacing Google and eBay and Amazon and Hulu as the kind of the brand names in the system, they can go to the venture capital market. They can convince people to give them money because these newer companies can now reach their customers because net neutrality will be guaranteed and they won't get blocked by the big companies.
So here are three quick examples of what net neutrality means. Broadband companies giving priorities to Netflix traffic, for example, while slowing Google searches. They won't be able to do that. The company T-Mobile offers a free music streaming service to your phone that's exempt from a customer's data cap. That service would be banned. Here's a third one. AT&T has a program whereby app companies subsidize the cost of your phone data that the app uses. That would have to stop. Jim, what's your response to first of all, respond to Markey, who sort of equated this to, you know, progress in the civil rights movement. I mean, he literally said that.
Yeah. This is a complicated issue because the whole idea of having, you know, free and unfettered access to all content is something I think we all support. I guess my take on it is, if you like your broadband as it is and you want it to immediately address issues of free and unfettered access to content, then you're for this. If you take a longer term, you might be against it. And I guess here are my fears. First and foremost, think of who the head of the FCC is. He is someone who was the government affairs rep for cable companies. You might think he might have an interest in what happens to the cable companies. Mm-hmm. In 2014, April, he came out with a document that was very much in a different vein. He was actually considering rules that would allow internet service providers to violate net neutrality. Now he's twisted to become a champion of net neutrality. I wonder what's in the details. So here are my questions. Can the FCC actually reclassify the entire industry as not an information but as a communications industry? If they can do that, then in essence, we'll be turning these companies into more something that's more akin to utilities, much more regulation, probably a lot less innovation. So question number two, would it slow down investments in broadband? So if you think about Google Fiber and other companies that are new competitors, new marketplace participants, would they be affected by any slowdown there? And why haven't net neutrality supporters like Google, Facebook been supportive of this yet? You would think they would have come out for it. I guess what I would prefer is the FCC identify ways to make sure we can secure more market participants who can compete with the Comcasts, with the Verizons, and others who are in this market, because I think more competition would be helpful in the short term in addressing this, and long term, it would help to actually change the industry to something we probably can't even imagine.
Interesting. We're going to be hearing and talking more about this next week, and we're going to actually be hearing from critics of net neutrality. I mean, I think you touched on this, Jim, or you edged close to this, because among their concerns, first of all, is this necessary? Could it lead in the long term to things like taxes and fees like we see on our gas and phone bills, right? What do you think, Marcella?
Well, I take a more optimistic approach, I guess. I perhaps those two things, you know, the fact that cable companies are going to be seen more like utility companies, I don't think that's necessarily in contradiction with more innovation or less innovation, rather. I think that the head of FCC, he definitely had a huge change of heart. And I choose to believe, I think, perhaps rather naively, that it had to do with the huge amount of comments that the FCC website had when they opened up this for discussion, and, you know, millions of people mm-hmm. flooded the website in support for net neutrality. I think that perhaps they realized that this was something that only cable companies, the ones that benefit from it, are opposed to, you know, net neutrality. Whether the long term prospects are more dim, like James suggests. I mean, plus this is not a policy yet. There may be some last minute lobbying efforts by the cable companies that completely stop this.
Lobbying efforts, not to mention a very likely legal action challenging this as well.
I mean, correct.
That's pretty much a foregone conclusion. We've got just enough time left for our hubbubs, those stories that fell below the fold but caught the eye of our panelists nonetheless. Jim Sturgis, what's your hubbub today?
My eagle eye caught the fact that the Patriots won the Super Bowl. Actually, my hubbub is the outright closure of Kenmore Square.
I didn't know you were a sports fan. Sorry. Okay.
I picked that up earlier this morning from the news. My hubbub is actually the outright closure of Kenmore Square, a story that fell off the map after the Pats' victory and all that snow. And I think we should have a discussion as to whether we will accept these extreme measures, in my view, of crowd control. I understand rerouting cars. I understand putting in place parking bans. But when I went to walk to Kenmore Square to go grab a drink at Eastern Standard, my first of the night, by the way, so I encountered the phalanx of police officers. I mean, literally hundreds of police officers with their lights, their car, trucks. I couldn't pass. And when I went to him, I said, I'm just going to walk. No, you can't walk through. I'm happy with reasonable accommodations given fears around snow and all that sort of stuff. I think we need to protect our right of assembly.
Marcella Garcia, your hubbub.
Well, there was certainly not a shortage of hubbubs this week, because certainly the snow and the Patriots were front and center everywhere. So I'm kind of a little tired of that. But one thing that caught my eye was how the trustees of Boston University voted to reject a proposal to divest from gun makers. And I saw this. I was kind of disappointed. I think they missed an opportunity to send a strong and, yes, rather symbolic message against gun violence. Other universities have done it. Princeton and public pension funds in other parts of the country have done it. And I think, again, it's hard to see how a university like BU divesting from gun companies would lead to less gun violence or making a dent in, you know, this company's profits, but it was a symbolic message, and I think they a message of awareness, of consciousness, and so I think they missed a huge opportunity to do that.
Well, my hubbub is about this really sort of extraordinary story about NBC Nightly News anchor Brian Williams, which I know was not below the fold at all, but I want to sort of talk about it in this way. In case you missed it, Williams apologized for saying that he had been in a helicopter that had been hit by a rocket and forced down during the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Now, over the years, he told the story several times, told it again just a few days ago, until a veteran who had been on the actual helicopter that was hit blew the whistle on Williams on Facebook. Williams was in a chopper, but not on the one that was hit and forced down. So finally, Wednesday night, after years of telling this story, Williams says this to his millions of viewers.
This was a bungled attempt by me to thank one special veteran and, by extension, our brave military men and women, veterans everywhere, those who have served while I did not. I hope they know they have my greatest respect and also now my apology.
But here's my question. Was that really an apology? And if so, what was he apologizing for exactly? Because he mentioned a bungled attempt to thank a special veteran, which sounds to me like he's taking credit for being a patriot rather than taking responsibility for telling a lie or at least embellishing a story and basically dining out on it for years. But there's another really important point here that Nancy Youssef made. She's a veteran war correspondent who now works for the Daily Beast in Cairo. She expressed it really well this week on Facebook. She says, the Brian Williams story is symptomatic of a bigger problem in journalism these days. Too many journalists think the point of their work is to brag about their near-death experiences. They make the story about them when it is surely not. She says that war correspondents are brave. They put themselves in harm's way. But the point is, that's their choice. They can leave and go home when they want. The people they're supposed to be covering can't do that. They should be the focus of the work. And to that, I say hear, hear. There's a great old newsroom maxim, by the way, that journalists like Brian Williams might consider. It's not about you. It's about journalism. So with that.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear. Stay with us. I want to thank my columnists, our team, Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, and Marcela Garcia, Editorial Page Contributor for the Boston Globe. Thank you both. Have a great
weekend.
Pleasure
to be with you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And listeners, stay with us. We'll talk about kids and money. When's a good time to talk to your kids about your finances? Should you give them an allowance? We'll be taking your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.